All right. There's not a lot of time left in this semester, I don't think. And the Phaedrus is going to take a while. It's a complicated text. I like to give a full 3 weeks to that. It's very long and complicated. Very complicated. And I do want to get to Poetical Dictionary next week. So let's see how far we can get through McLuhan today. So please open your texts to where we last left our hero with the little hand page, okay? We're going to read through, try to make sense of this book. This is an enjoyable book, isn't it? No. This is a treat, this book. I mean, it's like a classic that no one actually reads anymore. And it's really, really smart, and it's really, really useful. And has a lot of good licks in it. Had you ever read this? No. This was composed, produced. Yeah. It's not Jeremy Agel putting it together. It was actually he did it on purpose.
But it reads kind of like a collage.
Yeah. What I like is that, you know, you get McLuhan writing all these essays and these sort of philosophic, academic, sociologic essays, and then he does this book. And he did a lot of books like this, actually. You know, where he actually performed his argument.
I sort of a technical question, I was wondering if this was maybe some sort of trick along the same lines. There's the final cartoon, it's a New York cartoon, mm-hmm. and it says 1966. And it said this is published in 67. Is it?
Yeah, so McLuhan was writing a lot of before this.
Oh, okay. So this is not.
This isn't his only book. Yeah. He has a massive oeuvre.
Yeah, okay.
All right. He's also Canadian. Neil Young, the Guess Who. Joni Mitchell.
Jim Carrey.
Marsha McLuhan. All right. Let's look and let's read through some of this. He makes his argument quite clear here. So the second full paragraph there. So societies have always been shaped more by the nature of the media by which men communicate than by the content of the communication. It's a very simple argument. That's basically the argument, right? That the means of communicating shape us more than the content does. Well, what's he talking about? Well, think about, a book versus a cell phone. Think about a cell phone versus a home phone. Think about, you know, a landline. Think about writing a letter versus text messaging. Think about the iPod versus the LP. Does it matter what you text message? It's irrelevant for McLuhan's argument. His argument is that these paths of communication that we exist in, by nature, choreograph, define how we interact with things. That's what media is. Media is the terms with which we communicate with things. Media is not, you know, violence on television. Media is television, a certain speed, a certain relationship to a broadcast medium, right? McLuhan actually makes a very cool argument about television. He says television, unlike film, where film is projected and you all look at the projection. TV projects at you, right? You become the screen. The thing projects sort of onto you. You become the vanishing point, right? And so television for him is about a certain relationship between viewer and information and the world, right? So he talks about, you know, the Vietnam War and the speed with which we were watching a war clear around the world. Think how different that is than getting news reports, from World War II compared to, you know, my favorite example, the War of 1812, which I still don't know what that is. Right, in hearing about what's happening. How would you hear what's happening? How do you know what's happening? What does it mean to know what's happening? Fundamentally, the relationships between people are shaped by the means with which they can communicate. It's almost a really obvious argument. But it's quite radical because it shifts our orientation, right? It shifts how we approach critique, how we approach analysis. Content, the what, takes a conspicuous second seat to the how. why this is a distinctly rhetorical argument. Right? Societies have always been shaped more by the nature of the media by which men communicate than by the content of the communication. Right? Again, it doesn't make a difference whether it's the Declaration of Independence, right? But the Declaration of Independence written versus the Declaration of Independence broadcast on the internet is a fundamentally different document. The content, the what, doesn't really matter. It's secondary. Right, well, the light comes out of it. The light shines on you.
Right. Does
the light reflect off the paintings and not television? Sure. But, I mean, television is quite literally a light. Right? It's filled with lights, electric lights that shine out right onto you. Right? Light's not reflected. Light emanates from it. It is a light source. And whether he's right or wrong doesn't make a difference. The point is the terms of analysis. We're never interested in whether someone's right or wrong. We're interested in his text. And his text asks us to consider media, and the terms of communication. What's the next obvious point for a rhetorician? Well, then how do you communicate, McLuhan? How does this text operate? And that's what we've been looking at. Right? What are the paths of communication? What are the ethics? How does it stand towards us? And how do we stand towards it? The alphabet, for instance, is a technology that is absorbed by the very young child in a completely unconscious manner, by osmosis, so to speak. My kid knows the alphabet. He learned the alphabet song very quickly. He has no idea what it is. He has no idea. He's slow in some categories, right? So the whole letter, number, shape, it's all the same thing to him, right? But still, he knows the order. He knows that things go in order. Very interesting, right? And if you say, you know, you present him with letters in a different order, he'll say, no, that's not the right order. So what is it he's learned? He's not learning to read. He's not learning the sounds of these things. He's learning that things have an order. They go in a consecutive linear line. That's what he's taught by the alphabet. Right? Did it ever freak you out as a kid? You know, why do the letters go in this order? Why do they have to? Why do I learn it like this? What difference does it make? Right? Letters are a database. It should be able to go in any order whatsoever. A is the first letter. Right? Why do we learn an alphabet as a consistent set of letters that go in a certain linear line? Because that is the medium. That's McLuhan's argument. That's the nature of the medium. The alphabet is part of a whole machine of linearity and of fragmentation. Letter is a piece that goes into a line. Right? Does that make some sense? Didn't that bother anybody growing up? You just learned your alphabet. You guys, you're like in the Matrix, man. Unplug. We got to get you out of there. I will play Morpheus. You got to get out, man. You got to unplug, right? You're slaves, right? You got to think about things like the freaking alphabet, right? The alphabet, for instance, is a technology that we absorb by osmosis, so to speak. Words and the meaning of words predispose the child to think and act automatically in certain ways. The alphabet and print technology fostered and encouraged a fragmenting process, a process of specialism and of detachment. Electronic technology fosters and encourages unification and involvement. How does it do that? Speak more about this, right? What does he say about the alphabet, about this written kind of language, the book, the printing press? How does it fragment us? How does it isolate us? You read this book? What do you think?
Before we're given a specific order that things have to be put in, there are any number of options for the order. And then once we're given it, that's the only way that can be perceived.
Sure. But even in a way more fundamental is the fact that there is an order. Think about if we only communicated in visual glyphs. If we communicated, right, only through like painting, right? You think about what you could present all at once versus the sentence, right? We talked about how when you're reading a book, you can't, or let's say a newspaper, we have like six columns next to each other. That's a lot of information coming at you at once. Yet you can only read one column kind of at a time or one word at a time. It's the nature of the beast. Right? And you might be good at seeing something out of the corner of your eye and become kind of a peripheral reader. Nonetheless, the word, when you're reading words, you have to read that word, and then the next word, and then the next word. It keeps you in a specific space, right? You get kind of confined to that space. Now picture looking at a painting. Think how much information you get simultaneously looking at that painting, right? Looking at a visual canvas, right? Without words. Does that make sense? You get a lot of information all at once, right? When you look at a person, you get a lot of information from that person simultaneously, right? You see their clothes, you see their hair, you see their mood, you get their smell, you get a lot of information all at once. Now picture thinking only and communicating only in sound. Right? Sound not only comes all at once, but it kind of surrounds you. Right? It's multidirectional. Right? This is McLuhan's point. The word versus the visual image versus the sound, each one inflects our experience, the speed of our experience, how we make sense of things. In fundamental ways. It doesn't make a difference what that word is, what it's an image of, what the sound is. But sound itself, the visual image itself, the word itself, obliges a certain kind of behavior. It coerces us into how we construct our thoughts and how we communicate and can even relate to each other. So skip to page 44. Says the dominant organ of sensory and social orientation in pre-alphabet societies was the ear. Hearing was believing. Right? The phonetic alphabet forced the magic world of the ear to yield to the neutral world of the eye. Man was given an eye for an ear. Right? Throughout this book, McLuhan is going to pun. He's going to pun constantly. He's going to rearrange the familiar expressions. Right, like hearing, like we say seeing is believing, he says hearing is believing. He's going to constantly reorder things. This book is a book of puns, right from the get-go. For medium is the massage. And why? What is he like about the pun? The pun jams things together, right? And why is he interested in jamming disparate things together? Because it exposes the invisibility and the sort of insidious invisibility of the media environment, right? When you hear hearing was believing, you go, wait, that's not right. Something's fundamentally wrong. And it exposes seeing as believing as not just a cliche. It makes you see it now as an argument instead of just taking it for granted. Right? This book is an attempt to have you not take your media environment for granted. Right? That is his main mode of analysis. That is the mode of what he does with the cut-up and the pun and jamming disparate things together. Western history was shaped for some 3,000 years by the introduction of the phonetic alphabet, a medium that depends solely on the eye for comprehension. The alphabet is a construct of fragmented bits and parts which have no semantic meaning in themselves and which must be strung together in a line, bead-like, and in a prescribed order. If its use fostered and encouraged the habit of perceiving all environment in visual and spatial terms, particularly in terms of a space and of a time that are uniform, continuous, and connected. That is a great rhetorical moment in this text. Because I'm trying to read it out loud, continuous and connected, and turn it into sound. But how would I turn this into sound? Right? This moment in the text is a distinctly visual moment. I would have to say C, comma O, comma N, comma T. Right? I couldn't even just read the letters, because how would I distinguish between the comma and the dash? Right? This is his point. It is a privileging of the eye. There's nothing good or bad about privileging the eye. It is just a fact. It is an inventory of effects. Okay? The line, the continuum, the sentence is a prime example, became the organizing principle of life. As we begin, so shall we go. Rationality and logic came to depend on the presentation of connected and sequential facts or concepts. Right? For many people, rationality has the connotation of uniformity and connectedness. I don't follow you means I don't think what you're saying is rational. Visual space is uniform, continuous, and connected. The rational man in our Western culture is a visual man. The fact that most conscious experience has little visuality in it is lost on him. Right? So rationality and visuality have become interchangeable. The fragmentum activities, our habit of thinking in bits and parts, specialism, reflected the step-by-step linear departmentalization process inherent in the technology of the alphabet. Right? It's an amazing argument he's making. Right? You ever try to make an appointment with an MD? Everybody's a specialist. No, I don't. I don't do stomachs. You got to go to stomach guy. I only do upper stomach. I'm an upper GI guy. You got to go to the lower GI guy. No, I do only the duodenum. Right? I only do assholes. I don't do the whole colon. That's beyond me. Right? I mean, everyone's hyper specialized. And his argument is that comes from the alphabet. The will to specialization is the will to the alphabet, to a fragmentation. This is how the alphabet orders us, right? It's not just, I said a text choreographs your experience, right? I said, as you're reading a book, you go left to right. There's a sort of choreography of your whole sort of affective, emotional, perceptive, intellectual experience. McLuhan sort of ups the ante in a certain sense. It says it's not just the text that choreographs your experience. It's textuality, right? It's the medium itself that will, from the get-go, choreograph not just your body, but your very thinking and the very terms in which you are allowed to think, in which you can think, in which it is even possible to think. Him. So where were we? Back in the beginning. He says electronic media is different, right, than this visual medium. Right? Again, let's go back to the beginning. Make sure we understand his argument, right? Electronic technology fosters and encourages unification and involvement. Right? I mean, what's amazing about the internet and the digital space and this rise of electronic digital media is that it is always already this kind of multimedia space. Right? Is the internet a space for writing? Is it a space for images? Is it a space for video? Is it a space for music? Which is it? It's for all of those things, right? And for the intimate relationships between those things and all sorts of grammars that exist between them. Right? It is in and of itself, electronic circuitry is in and of itself a multimedia environment. It is already a multiple medium. It is the medium of media. Right? And if rhetoric in a way is the argument of arguments, right? Electronic circuitry, the internet, is the medium of media. It is this thing that is always already multiple. It's a very strange medium in that sense. Right? It's a medium of proliferation and of the multifarious. Right? So turn the page. Page 10, he says, our time is a time for crossing barriers, for erasing old categories, for probing around. When two seemingly disparate elements are imaginatively poised, put in apposition in new and unique ways, startling discoveries often result. That, in a way, is a formula for this book. It's constantly jamming things together, discover things. What do you want to discover? Right? New affects, new possibilities, but also the exposing of the environment. He wants the thing that you take for granted, like the alphabet, to no longer be something you can take for granted. He wants to reveal it for the terms of operation it is, for what it coerces, for the power mechanism it is. Okay? He says, in order to function critically in our lives, this is how we have to think. We have to think in terms of media. And the first step is to get away from this sort of insidious co-opting of the term media to mean content. I mean, that's what's happened over the last 20 years, basically since McLuhan. That when we think of media, we think of the things that they are saying on television. But that is a way to blind us from the fact that they're on television. Right? When we think about media now, again, we think about what it is they're broadcasting. Ask anyone about the rise of media in our lives, and they'll talk about all the violence on television, sex on television. But that is a blinding. That reinforces the invisibility of the environment of the medium itself. Right? learning, the educational process, and this should be of note to us, seeing that we're at school, has long been associated only with the glum. We speak of the serious student. Our time presents a unique opportunity for learning by means of humor. A perceptive or incisive joke can be more meaningful than platitudes lying between two covers. Right? He's saying that we live in a fundamentally different time where we can't just read this book. I mean, that the old pedagogic mode was part of it. It comes from the alphabet. It comes from this old technology. Right? That everything needs to change in this electronic age. Everything, including how we learn, how we teach, the structure of our universities, the structure of a classroom. He starts talking about things like the teach-in, right? This kind of rhizomic or decentered teaching learning environment. I mean, I hope in some sense I've tried to encourage you to not be serious. Nothing is worse than people who are serious. The only thing worse than being serious, I think, is ambitious. I think it's the most deplorable character trait I know, is ambition. The medium is the massage, is a look around to see what's happening. It's a kaleidoscope of interfaced situations. Right? Notice again the pun of kaleidoscope, which is in and of itself. That pun, kaleidoscope, is itself an interfaced situation. Right? What is he interfaced? He's interfaced collision and scope looking. Right? And he's jammed those things together. Right, so he's made collision and seeing this kind of new mode, right? He's interfaced those two modes. This book is relentlessly performing itself. Right? Relentlessly performing its argument, and in so doing is teaching you to think and read differently, to think in terms and read in terms of an electronic medium. Right? To think and move you towards the pun, towards the acceptance of the pun, the amplification of the pun. Right, the pun that jams things together, that is a productive cut-up and appropriation of different possibilities that interface situations, that make new things, that produce new things, that invent, right? Invento, someone pointed out the other day. All right, skip ahead. We're going to skip this whole thing about extension. Page 26. We'll come back to the extension thing in a moment when we talk about ratios of perception. It says, all media work us over completely. They are so pervasive in their personal, political, economic, aesthetic, psychological, moral, ethical, and social consequences that they leave no part of us untouched, unaffected, unaltered. The medium is the massage, and the understanding of social and cultural change is impossible without a knowledge of the way media work as environments. What he's just told us, right, what he's about to tell us here, right, is that all media are extensions of some human faculty. Right? That the wheel is an extension of the foot. The book is an extension of the eye. Clothing, an extension of the skin. Electronic circuitry, an extension of the central nervous system. Right? I have a good friend who made something he calls the world clock. Right, and he put this is years and years and years, like the mid-90s, and he put webcams, live cams, in 24 different time zones. And then you could go to the page and you'd see, the world clock is actually more complicated, but this is one aspect of it. You would see all, you know, images, live images being fed on one page in 24 at once. So you see the whole world, every time zone, all at once. Right? Think how weird that is. You're sitting in your room. Right, what's in your room? Not that much stuff. But for some reason, your eyes can see what's happening all around the world. It's literally a kind of prosthetic. Your eyes have been extended through the network. Right? And the network becomes literally this extension of your nervous system. It can see all over the world. Does that strike you as strange? Right? That's what technology does. It extends and shapes our perceptive faculties. Right, I had this great realization a little while ago. I was walking in the Marin Headlands, and there are these old kind of bunker type things, where and guns and shit there, because we were defending against the Japanese in case the Japanese came on that coast to attack us during the Second War. And there's something so striking about it. There's literally like these little, it's like a metal concrete bunker kind of, with a little, comes out over the top of the hill, just a little bit. And what's that for? So somebody could look. Are we under attack? Some guy has to sit in there all day, looking out over the ocean, and see, are we going to be attacked? Is anything coming? What do we do now? What seems so absurd? It seems absurd to suggest that a human being will sit there and look to see if boats are coming. Now we go, no. We have radars. We have these machines up in the sky, satellite radars, radars out on boats, right? They got the drone, is that what it's called? The plane now that flies that's a dummy, right? Extends our eyes. Right? In fact, the human doesn't have to be there anymore. So now the human being is back at, you know, headquarters somewhere. Right? He could be anywhere. He could be in Washington, D.C. Oh, yeah, something's coming. He pushes a button and a missile, you know, hits the boat. Think about how that redistributes your body and our relationships quite in very real, palpable ways. Right? Does that make some sense? Right? I mean, the electronic, McLuhan's point is that all technology is this kind of extension of us. Right? And what's complicated about it is it's not just an extension of us, it informs us. It shapes us. Right? That's really his argument. That when it's not just my eyes now that are seeing the radar, it's that radar now that has shaped my eyes and shaped how I think about perception. Right? Now I don't think seeing is something I do, it's something machines do. Did anybody see this film called United 93, is that what it was called? Did you see this film? It was nominally about the hijacking of one of the 9/11 planes, and it's the re-hijacking, right? So it's a whole series of hijackings that go on the plane. Do you know what I'm talking about? And I guess it's based on a true story about the plane that for some reason, they don't really know why it went down, presumably because the passengers had stormed it. It's a great, great, great movie because it's a film that's not about heroism at all. It has nothing to do with 9/11 per se. It is about how information works and how knowledge works in an age of electronic circuitry. It is unbelievable in the age of the network. I highly recommend watching this film. It's really smart, right? Because what happens is the film opens and you're at some plane command central, and there's a blip on a screen. Planes are just blips on screens. Right? They're not actually looking at a plane. There's no windows in their office. Right? The person who's guiding all these planes in doesn't have a window. Right? And he just sees a blip. And the blip starts doing things it's not supposed to do. And he tries to talk to the blip, and the blip doesn't respond. Right? So he's like, huh. Right? Doesn't know what's happening. Right? They get some, there's electronic information because the cockpit is recorded. Right? All these cockpits are recorded. Right? So then he finds a tape. You know, he's like, let's listen to what's happening in that cockpit, because all cockpits are recorded. And he hears something about maybe the plane's being taken over. He doesn't know really what's going on. No one really believes it, knows what to do. The next thing you know, of course, the blip has left his domain, and now it's over like Cleveland or something. That's a new, you know, command central. Right? So it's like, now you have a blip. Right? So now they're networking, they're on the phone with each other. Right? And then they can't find the plane anywhere. Right? And then, I know I'm giving you some detail, but it's kind of cool. Right? And then they lose the plane. They don't know where it is. No one knows where this plane is. Right? Next thing you know, they call people in like Jersey, maybe it's at Newark or something. And they're like, I think the plane's somewhere around there. I don't know where it is. And you see a guy stand up and he can see an airplane with his eyeballs. Right? He leaves the screen. He stands up. He looks out his window because he has a window. Right? Real eyeballs. Sees a plane go into the World Trade Center. Right? And they're just sitting there. And they still don't know what's happening. No one knows what's happening. Right? What's the relationship between that blip that then was over there, this plane? Does that blip equal that plane? What's the relationship between a blip on a screen and something happening in real time, in real space, right in front of you? They didn't know. Nobody knew. They're still on the phone. The fucking plane is in the building. And in hindsight, we all know what was happening. But the fact that, that wasn't the plane they were tracking. It was a different plane. The point being, this film does a very good job of showing what happens, right, when information and our senses are extended through this electronic circuit. Now, the problem was that the rules of engagement with the military were old school. They still had a hierarchy of command, right? So you get this whole network of people talking to each other, trying to figure out what's happening. Nobody knows what's happening. They're all on the phone. Most of this film, people are on the phone looking at a screen. What's happening? What's happening? What's happening? I don't know. What's happening? Do you know what's happening? Then they call the military, and the military doesn't know how to respond, right? It's that great phrase, rules of engagement, right? We go, okay, we think there's hijacking. What do we do? I don't know. No one knows what to do. They got to go up the whole chain of command. But the problem is information is all disseminated, right, laterally through a network. But the military is hierarchical. So they literally don't know how to make a decision. By the time they made a decision and planes had taken off, the whole thing was over. Right? The tools of the old technology don't work for the tools of the new electronic age. When information is networked, happens incredibly quickly, right? You can't function with a rigid hierarchy. It just doesn't work. Right? It's why our military is kind of under siege right now. Right? And they're trying to figure out what to do. Media, by altering the environment, evoke in us unique ratios of sense perceptions. It's a great phrase, man. Right? Media, by altering the environment, evoke in us unique ratios of sense perception. The extension of any one sense alters the way we think and act, the way we perceive the world. Right? So if you think about our senses, and you think about the medium we're in, each medium distributes our senses in different ways. It amplifies certain things, de-amplifies others. So obviously when we talk about a visual culture, it's not that we don't hear things. It's stupid. It just privileges the visual. The ratio of the visual to the phonic, to the aural, is shifted. So again, think about a text message, an email, writing a letter. Right? Think about the relationship your senses have to all these things. Right? When you write a hand letter, there's a physicality of your arm moving, right? And your arm, your hand touching the page, right? And the page has a smell. The ink has a smell, right? And you wrap that. I'll never cease to be amazed by our mail system, our snail mail system, our real mail system, right? I take this piece of paper, I put in another piece of paper, I put ridiculously little amount of money on it, 41 cents, 41 cents, and I just take it to the corner, I drop it in a box, and that exact thing is gonna traverse the world, right? And clear across the country, you know, my mom is gonna open something I touched that has my smell. Right? Now, picture writing an email. Right? It's a very different kind of physical exertion, right? It is probably much worse for you physically because you're all hunched over, right? I mean, I know I sit at my computer like a hunchback, right? Right? But it probably has no smell except for the stench of your room. Right? The sort of inflection of your pen on paper, of your signature, of your way of writing has gone away, right? And it's not a good thing or bad thing, but it's a redistribution of our senses, right? And how we relate to each other, the speed with which we relate to each other, and this different ratio of our perceptive faculties. Right, text messaging is that weird thumb thing. Right, it's very different. And it's clearly made for youth, right? This culture is a culture premised on youth, right? I mean, who fucking read this thing, right? I mean, it's so small, right? I'm getting old. I need things big, big text, right? On my computer, I put everything 14 point. I gotta see those letters, right? I can't see this little tiny thing, right? So it's a privileging of youth, but it's a whole redistribution of our senses. Does that make sense? That's his point. All media in some way distributes our senses in these different ratios. It's not a good thing or a bad thing. It simply is a different distribution. The question is, what is the distribution? How does this or that medium shape or distribute our bodies, distribute our sensory perceptions, distribute our central relationships with other human beings, with ourselves, with our environment. That's what a medium is. It is an environment. It is the inflection, the shaping of an environment, all the way down to the distribution of your senses. Does that make sense? I've noticed recently using the portable, the iPod, the whole portability thing, and the fact that at home it's very hard to listen to music with a kid around because it makes for a lot of chaos. It makes everybody unhappy. And so I have all this music, tons of music, basically for the last 2 years, all the new music I've listened to, I've only really listened to with headphones. And secretly, I feel like I've never listened to it. For some reason, I feel like, because I still have an old technology, I feel like music to exist needs to inundate a space, not just my ears. And I feel like it needs to sing. And I feel like in my ears, it's like whispering to me. Right? It's a very different sensual relationship I have to this thing that's been very intimate to me my whole life, music. Right? And my relationship to the thing has been shaped by my medium. Now, the upside is I have the opportunity to do this. Right? Without an iPod, I had no music. I stopped listening to music since, you know, the little vampire was born. Right? Because it's too much. Although I will say one thing that's really interesting about kids is when they're really little, you can play them anything. They love it. The more chaotic, the better. Right? Because they haven't formed categories yet. And everything is just free flow. So my kid was so little, man, and I played just nutty, nutty things. He kind of dug it, but now he's like, he always says it's too loud, even when it's soft. Too loud. It's too much. He needs much cleaner things. That's why kids' music is so annoying, right? Because everything has to be very simple so they can put it together, like six elements, that's all. You know, put more than that, like a symphony. It's like, what's happening? It's too much. Right? So media, by altering the environment, evokes in us unique ratios of sense perceptions. Right? The extension of any one sense alters the way we think and act, the way we perceive the world. Right? So look at this great moment here. Jump to this. Right? The Renaissance legacy. So McLuhan's argument is that the book as a medium isolates us, fragments us, right? And leaves you just like the letter is a kind of fragment. A piece, the book kind of fragments us from each other. You read alone. Right? And I look out over you, right? You're all sitting there with you, oh, look at these. They're sharing. See, this is nice. Right? But the medium doesn't really care for it, does it? You can't, it's too small, and the book doesn't work for sharing. Right? So in the Renaissance legacy, the vanishing point equals self-effacement. The detached observer, no involvement. Right? The book kind of involves a certain kind of involvement, but here he's talking about the Renaissance and a certain production of the visual in which you always get to perceive the space. The image, the visual, doesn't implicate you. Right? You are the master of the space. Right? The view of Renaissance art is systematically placed outside the frame of experience. A piazza for everything and everything in its piazza. Another pun. He loves the pun. Right? And we know why he loves the pun. The pun is not just cool and goofy. The pun performs a very serious function. Right? And the relationship between the play and the serious is something that's run through this class, I hope you notice. Right? And will become quite explicit once again when we do Plato. Right? That perhaps the only way to be serious is to not be serious. Right? That's kind of McLuhan's point. So here you have a piazza for everything and everything in its piazza. The instantaneous world of electronic informational media involves all of us all at once. No detachment or frame is possible. Turn the page. Right? So 1 minute we're looking at a piazza. And look at how this is constructed and how it constructs you rhetorically. Remember we looked at those images the other day, like the Lutzenfreuds, and we talked about how an image literally puts you in a certain relationship to it. It constructs a kind of spatial rhetorical milieu that positions you. Does that make some sense? Right? Like where we talked about, where could you be standing as you're looking at this Lutzenfreud? Right? You're kind of above it, below. Where are you? How does it shape you? McLuhan's point here is in the Renaissance, right? Rise of the advent of the alphabet and the written word and the printing press and the beginning of this kind of detachment, fragmentation. You get the rise of this kind of aesthetic that allows you always to survey, right? So in in this Renaissance art, you sit here outside the painting and you get to survey the painting. Right? You get to survey the place. Right? It doesn't implicate you. You are the master. Right? You are the looker. Right? The gaze is there for you to look at. Does that make sense? You flip the page here, and what happens? What happens when you get to this page? What do you have to do? You go to the bathroom. Well, for various reasons, but what's in the bathroom? Right, you get a mirror. And what happens? What do you see when you look in the mirror? Is it only this? What's the other thing you see when you look in the mirror to read this text? What's the obvious thing? Yeah, yourself, right? You are quite literally folded into the frame of this text. You are denied your objective perspective. You're literally in the book, right? The moment this book is activated in the mirror, you're, right? That's this beautiful move he makes, right? From the detachment to the involvement. And is why I argue this book is itself electronic circuitry, because it involves you. You get folded into it, right? It doesn't allow you a thorough detachment, right? But implicates you explicitly, yeah. Okay, people read it backwards. Right, but that's... Yeah, you're still shaped. I mean, so you don't fold yourself into the frame. You just have to read real weird. I mean, that's... I mean, right? And then you got to turn it upside down. Right? So the point is, again, that electronic circuitry is this kind of involvement, this kind of folding us in. There's no outside. Right? I mean, it really is this beautiful revolution going on right now in what's called Web 2.0, right? And this whole rise of the social network and the rise of what's called user-generated content. You want to be all fancy, right? This is the rise of UGC, right? User-generated content, right? And look at YouTube versus ABC television. It is a fucking revolution, man. ABC television, you know, makes these shows out in some weird studio to insult you, and then broadcasts them, pushes them to you, and it's on at a set time in a set place, and you sit and watch it. Right? What happens on YouTube? You're the publisher, you're the audience, right? There's a fundamental redistribution, right? An involvement, right? It's no longer push media, it's bottom-up media. Right? It's the end of these of this what we call push media. Media that just is a great studio that makes its film and then broadcasts it to you and you just sit there and watch it. Right? The studios are hanging on for dear life. And how do they hang on to dear life? They make films contingent on greater and greater expense. You need $400 million to make a film. Right? And it's why a film like, you know, they're ambivalent about a film like Blair Witch. Right? Three kids and a camera. Right, would it cost them $50,000? Right, undo the studio system, right? Especially when you have a different means of distribution, right? When you don't need a big reel that needs to be shipped to a movie theater, right? Movie theaters are collapsing, right? At rapid pace, right? You get the proliferation of the multiplex. It's the only way they can make money. All the single movie theaters are going away in San Francisco. They're, I think, all gone. Except for some repertory houses like the Castro, right? But any new release film movies houses that would just show one movie, basically all dead, right? It's too expensive. Right? Now we have a whole distribution channel for media called the internet. Anyone can make a movie? Look, you got the means right here. Right here, I got a fucking video camera in here. Tell me that's not unbelievable. I can make a movie right here and broadcast it all around the world. Think of the involvement now, right? Electronic circuitry involves us. We are programmers of our own media consumption. And the beautiful thing on YouTube, you can go there, you can create your own movie channel. It says, subscribe to this channel. Certain people have better channels than others. Right? ABC is dead. The whole push is gone. The whole active-passive is gone. Now it's constantly active. We are active creators, active consumers. YouTube is nothing less than a fundamental revolution in media, right? that redistributes us in fundamental ways. Who's a producer? Who's a consumer? That relationship has changed dramatically. Is this making sense? Electronic circuitry involves you in fundamental ways. That's what YouTube is, right? You create the video. Your friend right next to you creates the video. You consume it. You comment on it. You're active, right? Old television was a hierarchy, right? It was a push. It was on or it wasn't on. TiVo was the beginning of the revolution of that, right? TiVo took TV by storm. It undid TV advertising dollars because now you don't need to. The way TV makes money is through ads, and you don't got to watch ads anymore. Right? And so television doesn't know what to do. So what's happening? They're all going here. Right? CBS television, you know CBS? Right? They're a media company. And now they realize that television is dying. What have they gone into? Right? They own a ton of billboards. They bought Last.fm. Do you all use Last.fm? Does anybody here use Last.fm? You don't know what Last.fm is? Really? It's got like 50 million users, yeah.
I think like free analog TV is disappearing in the next year.
Absolutely,
so
right.
So you have to pay for even like basic...
Yep, very good, right. So yeah, actually digital television is now required within a year. Right, it's a revolution, right? And you'll see that at some point these things will begin to merge. There won't be such a clear space between them. Right, as the internet gets more and more effective as a broadcast medium, right? And right now, if you blow up a big flash movie on YouTube, it looks pretty crappy. Right? It's very hard, very slow. But that's a matter of time. Electronic circuitry involves you. You now need to make decisions about what you produce and what you view. It's not just, I look at the TV guide and I see what's on. You become an active curator of experience. Right? The whole world becomes an inventory, a database, that now it is incumbent upon you. Right? You can't be a passive viewer anymore. If you go to YouTube, it's very hard to be passive on YouTube. You got to make a decision. It's not like turning on the TV and it's pushed at you. And YouTube, if nothing else, you have to click. You have to make a decision. Does that make sense? Right? That electronic circuitry involves you. Right? The way this book involves you, folds you into the frame. Do you have any idea what I'm talking about? Do you guys go to YouTube? I'm glad you laugh, right? That means you probably just take it for granted. Right? But it's unbelievable. Right? It is a fundamental redistribution of how we exist and stand towards each other, how we stand towards the world. Fundamentally. All right. Turn to 63. Right? It says, ours is a brand new world of all at onceness. Time has ceased. Space has vanished. We now live in a global village, a simultaneous happening. We are back in acoustic space. We have begun again to structure the primordial feeling, the tribal emotions from which a few centuries of literacy divorced us. Such a bizarre, beautiful argument he makes. You realize how nasty and exquisite this argument is. Electronic circuitry, the internet, is primordial. Right? That returns us to a tribal existence. Right? We tend to talk about the rise of the internet as alienating. Right? Everyone just sits in their room all day on MySpace. They don't actually talk to each other. Right? That's an older generation who doesn't know how to make sense of this new media world. The fact is you're in intimate contact with strangers. You're hooking up with strangers, man, all the time. That's what this medium does. That's what it's about. That's what it facilitates. Right? It is a global village. Right? And again, it's an exquisite thing that you think you're in this radically new world. We are. But McLuhan's nifty argument is that in a weird way it's a return or a repetition of tribal culture. Right? Where people sit around and tell stories. Right? Think about YouTube. It's a beautiful way of looking at YouTube as a bunch of people sitting around telling stories. Right? And each little video is another story. Right? I got one. And what's most of YouTube is most people taking, besides just filming themselves, doing, I mean, it's really bad, the overwhelming majority of it. But it's irrelevant, right, because the content is irrelevant. What is interesting is the medium, right? Are people taking existing things and cutting them up, right? Or putting new soundtracks or splicing, because now every computer is a production studio, right? You can cut up, you can make your own videos, right? There are all these tools to metabolize existing media and regurgitate it, right? So that's what 90, I mean, when I mostly only go on YouTube with my little boy and we're looking for crap, and it's somebody has taken some nature video and put some death metal video on it. I mean, that's basically what it is. It's like heavy metal videos on top of animals killing each other. And I'm like, oh, buddy, let's try a different one. Right? I'm just looking for those PBS, that beautiful PBS voice, that voice of wisdom. It's all okay that we kill each other. Right? So you become this little, your computer becomes this metabolic machine that consumes media and spits it back out new. Right, so what we get is this constant metabolizing of ourselves, is taking up stories, reproducing them, disseminating. Right, you become this productive node within the network. You don't just sit there at your little computer. You sit there and you make shit and you spit it back. Right, what's amazing about the internet, unlike television, right, is that it is a read-write mechanism. It both reads and it writes. Television is a read-only. It's pushed to you, you read it. Same with the book. It's pushed to you. You read it. Or you don't. But you can't write. Right? The internet is a read-write. It is a two-way pipe. Information comes to you. Information goes away from you. You are a productive node within the network. It is a fundamentally different configuration of you and how you use your body. Oh.
And that what you're describing is the return of ancient technology, right, to a more primitive tribal culture is also a kind of undoing of that individual.
Good. That's awesome. That's awesome. So John's talking about the pun where he says an eye for an ear, is that what he says? An eye.
Yeah.
And that the eye there is a pun, not just EYE, but I. Right, because one thing that happens in this age of electronic circuitry, just like in the global village, is that you're not a radical individual. Right, the book makes you a fragment. You're an individual. You are unto yourself. You own your property. You are, you know, you are this unique thing. Where what the global does is actually you're a node within the network. That's the tribe. Right? Same with electronic circuitry. You're a node within a network. Right, so that I is actually a proliferation of possibilities of you dispersed through the network. Right, where some people were having an anxiety or claiming that McLuhan is poo-pooing or afraid of this loss of the I. On the contrary, he's saying, no, this is okay. This is groovy. This is what's happening. And it's kind of non-judgmental. He's like, listen, electronic circuitry distributes our I-ness, our individuality, in such a way that we are always already a network and enmeshed within a network. Right? When media is being pushed to you, you're alone in front of your TV. The TV in the old days sort of mimicked the book. It still tries to kind of mimic the book. Right? It's this discrete, you'll sit alone in this discrete environment and watch this thing, right? Now what happens when you can write back to the television? Right? TiVo was the first thing. It was the first time you could begin to write to your television. Television speaking to you, like, no, boom, think not. Now imagine if it's coming in, you don't just stop it or record it, but you can begin cutting it up, rearranging it. You know, saying that was stupid. Why did they do that? And you get to rewrite it. Imagine you could rewrite the television show that was streaming into you. Right? That's what YouTube is.
Really, that's also like how you kind of create memories. Like looking at like page 113, that is kind of interesting how it talks about how like the alphabet sort of gets the iconography but how like the alphabet, you know, is kind of like television, and then you start to read it in different orders, and then it creates the difference.
We'll get to Plato. We have had to shift our stress of attention from action to reaction. We must now know in advance the consequences. Because of electric speed, we can no longer wait and see. George Washington once remarked, "We haven't heard from Benjamin Franklin in Paris this year. We should write him a letter." Right? At the high speeds of electric communication, purely visual means of apprehending the world are no longer possible. They are just too slow to be relevant or effective. Unhappily, we confront this new situation with an enormous backlog of outdated mental and psychological responses. We have been left D-A-N-G-L-I-N-G. Right? Our most impressive words and thoughts betray us. They refer to the past, not to the present. The point is, we don't have the tools, the technology to handle this new media. That we're still trying to jam it into the wrong shapes. I mean, think about this. This occurred to me this morning driving over here. I can't believe you guys still write papers. Right? You should be learning how to write always already in a hypertextual environment. Right? The written page, right? And right? I mean, the computer that we have now and the way we think about Microsoft Word and the printer is such that it still reifies the book. Everything's linear. Everything's in its place. Right? When the fact of the matter is what we have at our disposal is hypertextuality. Right? Meaning you can go from one place to the next in no particular order. Right? So when you're reading through, you know, a web page, it's got links internally, you click on them, you go somewhere else, you click on them, you go somewhere else, right? And you begin getting these constellations of information. Right? Imagine a class on writing that wasn't based on the linear page, the left to right five-page paper, but taught you the grammar of writing hypertextually. I've never seen anything like this. I can't even imagine how to begin to approach it because it's really fucking complicated. Right? I mean, when I'm not doing it for a business, it's easy when it's a business because there's a clear objective, sales. Right? But when you're actually trying to be creative, hypertextuality becomes very, very complicated. Right? But why are we writing, why are we even learning, still learning how to write like this? When the writing we should be doing should be multiple, shouldn't be linear. It should be rhizome, it should be a network. Your paper should be a network of different thoughts and streams and how they all intersect. Do you know what hypertext is? Again, it's when you click on a link and you go somewhere else. Have you ever seen this before? Like it used to be a blue underline. I don't think it is anymore. Right? But think about that. I mean, that's where we should be going. That's where, if this were a progressive department, right, and we were really a progressive rhetoric department interested in really teaching progressive writing, right, we'd begin teaching you to write hypertextually. There'd be at least a separate class on it. And you wouldn't be handing in papers. And I'm trying to figure out a way to begin phasing that out. Not just because it's a pain in the ass, but because maybe it's not the right thing to be teaching you. Although it does help still to know how to write. But maybe not by the time, you know, my boy's there. That's why I have no problem. He watches, he can't watch any television, but he watches a little bit, no commercials, I don't like commercials, but he watches some visual stuff. He can do it every day because he has to learn to think visually. I have no problem with TV. What's the problem with the visual, with movies? Right? We still have this weird prejudice. You let your kids watch TV. It's passive. It's not passive. You've got to learn to read actively. You've got to learn to read what's happening in the world. The world is this inundation of visual information. You've got to learn to make sense of it. Electric circuitry profoundly involves men with one another. Information pours upon us instantaneously and continuously. As soon as information is acquired, it is very rapidly replaced by still newer information. Our electrically configured world has forced us to move from the habit of data classification to the mode of pattern recognition. We can no longer build serially, block by block, step by step, because instant communication ensures that all factors of the environment and of experience coexist in a state of active interplay. Oh, that's a good... That's a good paragraph. Active interplay, right? I mean, think about, you know, all your bookmarks. Think about how many different things you got. You got your favorite porn site. You got your four favorite blogs. You got the weather coming in here. You got your two social networks here. It's a weird interplay. And you get all that information at once. You're sitting at your computer. You get a lot of different information at once. Oh, you know what's awesome is hilarious to me is on Facebook. Does everyone have a Facebook page for the most part? Maybe some of the other social networks do this, I don't know. But when you log in, it gives you your like dashboard, and it tells you your stories. And the stories are anything anyone has done in your network, right? So, you know, Joe put a picture of himself up. That's the news. It's instantaneous. The minute anything happens, it's news. There's no reporting anymore. The machine, the activity done on the machine is news of the machine that produces more, produces the medium and the content of the machine, right? It is in and of itself this, it's like an action done to it that then spits something else back out. Do you understand what I'm saying? It's an instant feedback loop. Right, here you are, right? And you're one of your friends is Joe, and Joe puts a picture up on Facebook, and now that's a news story on your page. It's this instantaneous news. The machine, any action with the machine is news of the machine. The machine makes more. It doesn't just report, it creates. Does that make sense? You understand what I'm saying? It's fucking hilarious to me. The first time I saw that on Facebook, I was like, what is this? This is so bizarre, but I began to kind of love it, right? I mean, almost 99% of the time, it's banal. It is Joe put a picture of himself up. But maybe if you think Joe's cute, you want to go check it out, right? Yeah, I wonder if it's a nice picture of Joe. I don't know. Right? It might be of some note. Right? But either way, it's the I don't care what the content is. Right? It's the fact, it's this medium, right? This speed. Right? This instantaneous speed of this machine that you write to and then writes back. Do you understand what I'm saying, right? It's simultaneous, man. It's so fucking funny to me. Right? You don't share my glee at this realization. All right, go to 68. I think we're making good headway here. So this is a key. This is one of my favorite couple pages here. It says, we have now become aware of the possibility of arranging the entire human environment as a work of art. What does that sound like? Anything we've read this semester? Nature, right? Everything's in play, right? Just keep recreating, keep inventing, mash things up, cut them up, be a free intellect. As a teaching machine designed to maximize perception and to make everyday learning a process of discovery. There's a great movement he makes there. He says the whole world's an art gallery, but also a teaching, because he doesn't separate knowledge from art. Right, just as Nietzsche says, that when you take two disparate things, you create new metaphors, you also create new knowledge. Art is not distinct from knowledge. Art is knowledge. Knowledge is art. So this book itself, right, arranges the world as a kind of art happening. At the same time, the book is constantly performing a pedagogy. It's teaching you to read and think differently. Right? He's made the two one and the same. Application of this knowledge would be the equivalent of a thermostat controlling room temperature. As an astronomer looking through a 200-inch telescope exclaimed that it was going to rain, his astronaut asked, "How can you tell?" "Because my corns hurt." What does that joke do for us? Why that joke?
Well, it's playing on the fact that, yeah, how much can you find out through this telescope if he's just looking at his feet? It's like a example, it's a contrast in like the technology, like this technology with like the fact that he's still using something that is like kind of unreliable or
totally reliable, right? Yeah, I mean, that's, it's, I don't think it's either pejorative or not. It's just, yeah. It is this kind of disconnect, right? Yeah, Stephanie. Yeah, but maybe it's the right technology, right?
Well, it might be, but at what point do you decide that the old technology is working? At what point does it just not stand with the point?
Absolutely, and that's why, I mean, this book is also an argument for the privileging of the media, for media analysis and being a media analyst, right? He tries to make this a discipline, media studies, right? What's happened, of course, in media studies is it's shifted to content. What is it the media is talking about? You know, my media, you know, studies dissertation, I'm talking about, you know, mentions of, you know, death in the news. Did you know that it was mentioned 300 fucking billion times in the last week? Media studies is gotten confused, right? But there should be, McLuhan's arguing, a media studies. We need media studies to look at whether things are outdated or not.
I think it's also playing with your expectations as mm-hmm. a reader.
Absolutely.
Because you're expecting him to be like, well, there's clouds or something.
Right.
It's just like, no, it's
yeah. It's a whole redistribution, right, of expectation, of affect, of knowledge. Where does knowledge come from? Right, that's part of McLuhan's point. Where does knowledge come from? Does it just come from the telescope, or does it come from everywhere? Does it come from your body, from your participation in the world? Your corns hurt. That's how you know things. You know things because your corns hurt. Why not? Is that an old technology? It strikes me as a very intimate, very palpable kind of technology. This is what he argues electronic circuitry is. Environments are not passive wrappings, but are rather active processes which are invisible. The ground rules, pervasive structure, and overall patterns of environment elude easy perception. Right? Nobody here ever thought about the alphabet. You just learn as a stupid song. It's not a stupid song, it's Mozart, but you know, you still learn it as a song. Right? You don't think that's the order. B comes after A. Right? It makes itself invisible. Right? And then you need to jam it somehow. McLuhan tries to jam the alphabet. Anti-environments or counter situations made by artists provide means of direct attention and enable us to see and understand more clearly. The interplay between the old and new environments creates many problems and confusions. Right? That's what that little joke does, right? He jams two things together, right, to reveal things. The main obstacle to a clear understanding of the effects of new media is our deeply embedded habit of regarding all phenomena from a fixed point of view. We speak, for instance, of gaining perspective. This psychological process derives unconsciously from print technology. This is a key part of his argument. He argues that the mode with which we analyze media needs to change, right? That when we try to analyze what's going from a psychological perspective, right, or from this fixed point of view, we won't get it. That fixed point of view, that psychologization, actually speaks back to your fragmentation as an individual that comes from print technology. So what tools of analysis, how do we make sense of the world in electronic circuitry? The very terms of critical analysis need to change. That's hopefully what we're beginning to learn in here. Right? No longer a fixed point of view, but the proliferation of points of view. Right? Print technology created the public. Electronic technology created the mass. How did print technology create the public? What's he talking about? Nobody read Kierkegaard's Present Age? Yeah. Good, perfect, right? Like, how if you didn't have a newspaper, a magazine, or some kind of thing, where would the public come from? What would the public be? It would just be you and the people around you, right? I mean, we very casually say things like, Americans believe, Californians believe. The fuck did you get that from, if not from something like a newspaper that literally creates that? You know what I mean? That USA Today, they love that, right? Americans think, and they have big pie graphs and things. What are they talking about? Aren't I an American? Are they telling you what America... It's a very strange world, but they literally create it. They create this thing called Americans, as opposed to us all being these little elements, right, alone with our little tribe. Right? So electronic technology creates something different from the public. It creates the mass. Right? And now it's very hard to kind of... I mean, with the public kind of, what newspapers kind of do and the rise of the printing press and this notion of the public... is it kind of made it more or less univocal. So we say things like Americans think, but electronic circuitry is networked so many different directions. It's breaking down national boundaries, local boundaries, age boundaries, gender boundaries. You don't really have a public, you just have a mass, an endlessly networked mass. Does that make sense, the difference between a mass and a public? The public consists of separate individuals walking around with separate fixed points of view. The new technology demands that we abandon the luxury of this posture, this fragmentary outlook. Here we go. The method of our time is to use not a single, but multiple models for exploration. Right? I love that. Right? And that's in a way what his book does. It's a way what we've been arguing all along to do, right? That rhetoric really is this art of the proliferation of perspectives. Right? That in a way everything we've been reading has been trying to undo the fixed position of any given perspective. and realize that it is just a perspective amongst perspectives. They're always trying to think multiply, right? And so McLuhan comes along here and makes a book that is that uses all these different methods. He uses jokes, he uses images, he uses sound, he uses the book. He includes the book as a possible tool to use because it is a technology. And the age we exist in, like I said about the internet, is a multimedia medium, right? Which means it includes the book. It supersedes the book. So it's not that the book goes away, but the book becomes one moment, one possibility within this proliferation of media, within the possibilities, within all the different ways you can arrange, you know, these ratios of our sensual faculties. All right, I want to get to one more thing. Talks about experts and amateurs. It says we live in an age of the amateur. Where the hell is that? What's wrong with experts? Yeah, why?
Because they've lost their modes of perception.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a really Nietzschean argument, right? The expert for McLuhan is a lot like Nietzsche's scientist or philosopher. They already know. How can they be part of a world that's changing when the expert is the person who knows already? Right? If you're an expert, I mean, try talking to an MD about, you know, homeopathy. They don't even know how to listen to you. I'm an expert. I know that doesn't work. Because why? Because I'm an expert. I'm an expert on, you know, cirrhosis. I'm an expert. Right? But the amateur doesn't know. Right? And McLuhan suggests that this new world, like Nietzsche's free intellect, entails a not knowing. You don't know yet. You have to go in, who knows what's going to happen. Right? In a world of electronic circuitry where networks are constantly emerging, in Nietzsche's world, where truth has been sort of exiled or rendered moot, and it's all a question of effect. You don't know what's going to happen next. The world is a place of chance. It introduces chance into its fold. Right? And that's the best place for the amateur. Does that make sense? The amateur doesn't know. The amateur is not so refined. It's why watching March Madness is a pleasure. And watching the NBA is excruciatingly boring. Right, has anyone watched basketball? Right, the NBA is unbearable, right? Unbearable. Right? What's the team that wins year after year?
Spurs.
Fucking Spurs. And what do? They have to be the most boring team to ever hit the court. Post up, pitch out. It's the same half-court play over and over and over again. Why is college ball? Why is it called March Madness? You would never say NBA Madness. They're all pros. Right? Everything's hyper-refined. Nothing that interesting happens. Once in a while, you get a cool play. The Warriors are fun for that reason. But why is it called March Madness?
NCAA is like, it's like the first time all these guys have been in this situation, it's, you see them, how they actually act under pressure. And like,
yeah.
It's
spontaneous, right? And they're constantly falling down, jumping over each other, right? There's a kind of mania. Because you don't know what's going to happen. It's madness for us to watch. You don't know what's going to happen. It's constantly crazy. It's not so predefined. Same with college ball. Right? You got to love college ball. College football, right? They have the entire repertoire of plays. They do things, you know, like the Statue of Liberty. They really do it. The flea flicker, they do it all the time.
Right, pro ball, no. You know, we got to march the ball. We got to at least get 5 yards, run up the middle.
You watch the NFL, you're like, oh my God, if they run up the middle one more time, right, I'm going to punch myself in the face. Right? It's so boring, you can't believe. Run up the middle, okay, we got 3 yards, okay, it's great. It's a great average. Right? You watch college ball, you never know what's going to happen. A whole repertoire, chance is introduced. Right? And the amateur embraces chance. You don't know. You don't know what's going to happen. So you got McLuhan down? You get it? You think you can think in terms of medium? All right, we can talk about it more on, I mean, there's beautiful things like this beautiful page. We can talk about some of this on Tuesday. So we will talk more about McLuhan on Tuesday, but I will also talk about Poetical Dictionary, okay? Does everybody have Poetical Dictionary? I don't care, you got to get it. Read it, whole thing. Weekend well.